Joining me now is economist Peter Schiff, founder of Euro Pacific Capital and the host of The Peter Schiff Show, which is available on YouTube and podcast. And many people may remember him, or if not, you definitely got to see the video from 2007, 2008, because he was the man who was literally laughed at on cable television by all the other financial pundits when he was warning that the housing market was about to collapse. And so many people wish they would have heeded his warnings. So I wanted to get him on the show to see what other kind of warnings he has and to talk about the strange economic situation that we're in now with the coronavirus and now with these growing civil unrest across the country. So, Peter, what's the forefront on your mind now with everything that's going on? What warnings do you have that you hope people will now listen to?
Well, you know, if you recall, it wasn't just the housing bubble that I was warning about or the imminent crash in real estate prices, but it was the financial crisis that real estate price collapse was going to cause. And so not only was I worried about that crisis and bank failures and the bankruptcy of Fannie and Freddie, but I was worried about what the government was going to do in response to the worst recession since the Great Depression and 10% unemployment and trillion-dollar budget deficits, because I knew all this was coming. And what I forecast was that the government would double down on the policies, the failed policies that inflated the housing bubble, that rather than acknowledging their mistakes and going down a different path, that they would try to reflate the bubble. And that's exactly what they did. They slashed interest rates down to zero and left them there for a long time, and they did quantitative easing. And as a result, we inflated a much bigger one than the one that popped in 08. And now I am warning about the far greater economic crisis, financial crisis, that is about to finally result from that much bigger bubble. And that's where we stand right now, except this is going to be a much bigger crisis than what happened in 2008. I mean, it's already begun. The recession that we're in now is going to be far deeper and far longer lasting than the one that we had then. The main difference is going to be the government's not going to be able to reflate the bubble. It's going to try, but what it's going to do is crash the dollar. And so what we're going to have is not only a deeper recession, but a big increase in consumer prices, something that we didn't have. We dodged that bullet last time around. We didn't get CPI going way up. But this time, we're going to have a lot of unemployed people who are going to be paying a lot more money for basic necessities. So this is going to be stagflation, only the stagnation part is really depression, and the inflation potentially could even be hyperinflation. So it's going to be much, much worse than the milder case of stagflation we had in the 1970s.
Now, in a five-year period from, I think, 78 to 82, we had approximately 48% or 50% inflation, basically. Are you expecting a 50% inflationary rate within a year? What is hyperinflation to you, and how long does it go? At what point does it stop?
Yeah, I don't really know, if there's a cutoff between when does high inflation officially become hyperinflation. I mean, does it have to be Weimar Republic, Germany, or Zimbabwe, right, where you're talking about wheelbarrows with trillions of dollars, right, before it's hyperinflation? Or, what if inflation is just 10%, 20% a year for several years in a row? I mean, that is really, really bad. I don't know if you call that hyperinflation or not, but whatever we're going to get, it's going to be very, very destructive. And the thing is that the only way the Federal Reserve will be able to prevent it from becoming hyperinflation, right? So even if we get 10% or 20% annual increases in the cost of living, the only way to prevent that from turning into something much worse, right, is going to be for the Fed to dramatically, reduce money supply and tighten up on policy by selling all the bonds that it's been buying and allowing interest rates to rise dramatically. But of course, the cost there is going to be horrific because we all have so much debt because the Federal Reserve kept interest rates artificially low for so long. Everybody loaded up on debt. And the only reason that people can even service that debt, forgetting about trying to repay it, but it's only serviceable at, 0% interest rates, where the rates are really low. Well, what happens if in order to rein in inflation that the Fed let get out of control, rates have to go to 10% or 20% like they did in 1980. They went to 20%. Well, what happens? You know, I mean, we have a $25.5 trillion national debt. It'll be $30 trillion maybe by next year. What happens if we have to pay 10% interest on that? That's $3 trillion a year. I mean, that's 100% of what the government collects in taxes. I mean, how are you going to be in a situation where every nickel of tax revenue is just to pay the interest on the debt and you have nothing left for anything else? I mean, obviously, this is going to be a massive collapse when the Fed is finally forced to allow rates to go up. Not only are all the big banks going to fail that we bailed out, but the depositors are going to lose their money because there's no money to bail them out. You're going to have massive defaults of debt, including the federal government. The federal government will have to default on treasuries. That's the only way to avoid hyperinflation, is for the government not to pay. Because if the Federal Reserve prints enough money to allow the government not to default, well, then the money's going to have no value because we will have hyperinflation.
So at this point, is there even any way to stop it? I know you and others, now it's been 12 years that I've been familiar with your work, you warning about these things. You should do this. The government should do this. The Federal Reserve should do that. The Treasury should do this. They're not doing it. It's almost like lecturing somebody who's 400 pounds to stop eating and they're not stopping eating and the heart attack is just around the corner. I mean, is there even any way to avoid this at this point, or are we going to see, you know, a third world, is the once great United States going to turn into essentially a third world country of the likes of which the world has never seen?
I think we already are a third world country. We're just not living like one. We still have the standard of living of a first world country, but we have the economic dynamics of a third world country in that we're not a manufacturing economy anymore. I mean, we're living off of what everybody else manufactures. And we're consuming or borrowing, rather, what the rest of the world saves. America is the world's largest debtor nation. If you look at the other creditor nations, those are the industrial nations. I mean, we're in a list of debtors, right, where we owe the world a lot more than the world owes us. I mean, at one time, America was the world's wealthiest creditor nation. In fact, as late as the early 1980s, we were the world's biggest creditor nation. Now we owe more than all the other debtor nations of the world combined. It's just that we've been able to live beyond our means because we create the world's reserve currency out of thin air, and we're able to use it to buy all the products that everybody else produces. And because we have the reserve currency, we're able to borrow at very, very low interest rates. But all of this is going to come to an end. I think it's going to come to an end soon. To answer your question, no, there is no way to avoid this, right? I mean, either we can bring the crisis on ourselves, or we can wait until the world forces the crisis upon us. Now, of course, by waiting for the world to do it, it's going to be much worse. But no politician wants to go out of their way to confront the problem now when they can kick the can down the road and get it past the next election. So that's what the game is now. It's about what can we do to delay the day of reckoning? Because it's going to be so bad that we just want to postpone it, even though success in postponing it is actually failure, because the more you succeed in postponing the crash, the worse the crash is going to be when it finally hits. But from political perspective, hey, they'd rather have a worse crash later than any crash now. So that's what we do. And then you have a lot of people who are delusional in that they believe that since we haven't had a crash yet, that we never will, right? They point to people like me who have been warning about these problems for years or even decades. And they say, well, you say, look, everything is fine. Look, the Dow Jones is at a record high. You know, so what are they talking about? We can borrow as much as we want. We never have to repay the debt. We don't have to save. We don't have to manufacture. The trade deficits mean nothing, right? The budget deficits, you know, they can grow to the sky. We can print as much money as we want. Doesn't matter where the balance sheet is, right? Because nothing bad is going to happen because nothing bad has happened. Well, bad things have happened. They just don't understand the source. But the collapse, yeah, the real crash hasn't happened yet, but that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. And by the time it does happen, it's too late to worry about it or do anything about it.
How does the average investor or the average American avoid getting completely wiped out? I mean, most workers have a 401k, some sort of a retirement plan, an IRA, things like that. Even if they're not sitting on a lot of cash savings, your responsible Americans have been putting money away in an IRA for, you know, perhaps 30, 40 years. What's going to happen to that money? Or is that going to hyperinflate and become, part of the part of the waste, essentially.
Well, most people are going to get wiped out financially. I mean, that's just what's going to happen. I mean, if you want to go back and look at the 1970s as an example, only this is going to be much worse than the 70s. But during the 1970s, you saw a huge decline in the value of the dollar, right? The dollar lost about two-thirds of its value during that decade, measured against other currencies, like the Deutsche Mark, the Japanese yen, the Swiss franc. But measured in terms of gold, the dollar lost even more value, right? At the beginning of the decade, gold was $35 an ounce. At the end of the decade, it was $850. So that is a huge loss of purchasing power. That's why prices went up so much during the 1970s. That's why you had all that inflation, was because we destroyed the value of the dollar. And the genesis of that destruction was really the 1960s, with the deficits that we ran in the 1960s to fight the Vietnam War, the war on poverty, going to the moon. You know, we did a lot of things that we didn't pay for. We borrowed money. Now, it was tame compared to what we're doing now. But there was a price to pay for that profligacy, and we paid it in the 70s. And, you know, Americans suffered. In fact, that's one of the reasons that so many women entered the workforce in the 1980s who were not working in the 1960s. Because in the 60s, married women didn't have to work because their husbands made enough money to support them. But by the end of the 70s, the husband's paycheck had lost so much value that the wife had to get a job. That was the only way that they could make ends meet. And a lot of people probably had to delay their retirement plans because money they thought was going to go a certain amount didn't, because prices went up. Well, that's what's going to happen.
Hmm? You're a gold bug. You're the president of Shift Gold. You sell gold, I understand, in Manhattan. Are you recommending that people just dump all of their money into gold? You know, if people would have taken that kind of advice back in 2008, they would have missed out on the stock market gains over the last 10 years as there was a recovery. Maybe President Trump sort of held the dam back from bursting, and his trade deals and deregulating sort of was an unforeseen blessing, you know, to sort of the supposed doomsdayers. What should people do with their money? I mean,
well, first of all, you know, I've never recommended that people put all their money into anything. And I don't recommend that people put all their money into gold and silver. They should certainly put some of their money into gold and silver. And by the way, if you go back to the year 2000, right, that time frame, the last 20 years, buying gold is actually better than buying the S&P. Even with the dividends that you would have earned on the S&P 500, just holding an ounce of gold for the past 20 years and selling it today actually gives you a better return. And I think, you know, over the next 10 years, you're going to see gold outperform the S&P 500. But I don't tell people to just buy gold and silver. I mean, you should have, you know, 5-10% at least in physical gold and silver. But I do believe that you should have good portfolios of foreign stocks. I mean, foreign stock portfolios did very well in the 1970s as the U.S. stock market was decimated by inflation and went nowhere in nominal terms, but got clobbered in real terms. But people made money in the Japanese stock market or in the German or the Swiss stock market. So we invest money for our clients around the world in markets where I think you're going to see an appreciated currency relative to the U.S. dollar, and where I think we get much better valuations in their stocks than what's available in the U.S. market. So we get better dividend yields, and we're investing in sounder economies that are not on the verge of a complete economic collapse, which is what we're about to experience here in the United States. So the key is to avoid getting wiped out through inflation, right? Most people are. And, you know, you look at all of the money that's being printed right now, right? We've had this huge increase in government spending in the last year, right, since COVID, although government spending was already ramping up under Trump before COVID, but now it's just kind of gone ballistic, right? So we're spending unprecedented. We're going to have a budget deficit of maybe $3-4 trillion, right, this year. I mean, incredible, the budget deficit. But where's that money coming from, right? I mean, the government is spending all this money. Who's paying for it? Who's getting the bill, right? The idea is that, well, nobody's getting the bill, right? Nobody's taxes are being raised. In fact, people's taxes are being cut. So how are we paying for all this government, this massive increase in government spending? You don't get all this government for free. Somebody's got to pay the cost. The idea is now, well, nobody pays for it because the Fed is just going to create the money. Well, okay. Well, what happens when the Fed just creates money out of thin air? because the Federal Reserve doesn't produce any products. It doesn't provide any services. It just creates money, right? And so if there's no additional goods and services, just a bunch of money, all that happens is the money that already exists loses value. So now when people get that money that the Fed printed and now they can buy stuff, they can only buy stuff because the people that had money before can buy less. Because now we have to increase prices so that the greater quantity of money, you know, can buy the same quantity of goods. And in fact, right now, because of the economic shutdown, not only are we printing more money, but we're producing less stuff. We're providing less services. People that used to be employed making things and providing goods and services are at home doing nothing and just cashing government checks. And so the way we're paying for all this government is with a massive inflation tax. The government is going to steal the purchasing power of anybody who has U.S. currency. And it's that stolen purchasing power that everybody is spending now. So if you don't want to be taxed to death by inflation, if you don't want to see the value of everything that you've worked a lifetime to save, if you don't want to watch that implode, which is what's going to happen, right? When prices are going up, it's not really prices that are going up. It's the value of your money that's going down. And so now you need more money to buy the same stuff. So if you want to avoid that tax, you need to get out of the dollar before the bottom drops out, before people realize what's going to happen. And you could take your dollars, and that's what I'm helping people do, to get rid of their dollars and buy real money, which is gold and silver, or exchange their dollars for foreign currency and then use that foreign currency to buy foreign assets, foreign stocks, foreign bonds. And so once you're in those other assets, the U.S. government can't tax you with inflation. They can only tax the people who hold U.S. currency. So if you hold gold, then you avoid that tax. If you own real assets outside the United States, you avoid that tax. But if you own U.S. treasuries, muni bonds, corporate bonds, anything that's tied to the U.S. dollar that pays a coupon in dollars, you're going to get wiped out. You are going to be bearing the cost of all the bailouts and all the stimulus. So if you don't want to pay it, then you got to do something now.
What has the recent unrest done to sort of change your forecast? Because when the Occupy Wall Street movement started in 2011, I think it was, you know, they started calling for massive socialist welfare programs, largely peaceful, you know, kind of looking back on that compared to this mass rioting of just complete anarchists who hate this country, who can't be reasoned with. What has this done to your forecast for, you know, what's going to happen to the once great United States?
Yeah, well, certainly we've kicked the can down the road for many more years than I thought, right? When I was writing my first book, Crash Proof, and I wrote that back in 2006, I didn't think we'd be in 2020 where we are now. I would have thought that the real crash, which was the title of a book that I wrote later, I think came out in 2013, I would have thought that that would have happened already. But we did succeed in postponing the day of reckoning. And so now it's going to be much, much worse. But I think what's really compounding the problem is the political shift that the nation has had. And I think it really started with the 2016 election, not with the election of Trump. But what I thought was really significant was how well Sanders did in the primary and how mainstream his socialist policies actually became within the Democratic Party. Now those policies are mainstream in the Republican Party. In fact, I think even Bernie Sanders is surprised at how far to the left the Republicans have already moved. And so the political dynamic has really, really shifted. We now have a Democratic Party and a Socialist Party, right? And I think the Socialist Party is probably going to prevail in the next election. And you already have this mood in the country, like in the Occupy Wall Street days, only worse, where there was a sense that the financial crisis and the Great Recession was the result of capitalism. Like there was too much capitalism, too much greed, and we just needed more government, and we would have been okay. And that was the opposite, the read. We had a bubble because of the Federal Reserve and because of Congress, Fannie and Freddie. I mean, it was moral hazard and artificially low interest rates that combined to inflate the housing bubble that resulted in the financial crisis. And the bailouts of the banks was not capitalism. Capitalism would have allowed banks to go under. They would have allowed people to lose money. That's what should have happened. we should have had more failures and more bankruptcies, but we didn't have capitalism. We had socialism. We had the government bailing out the bad actors. And so we compounded all the problems. And so this crisis, as I said, is going to be much worse. The recession is going to be far deeper. Far more people are going to lose their jobs, but they're also going to have to deal with a much higher cost of living. And I think people are going to again blame capitalism. They're going to say, you see, we told you capitalism doesn't work. Look at this disaster, right? And of course, the disaster was because of government interference with capitalism, but it's the capitalism that ends up getting the blame for the damage that socialism does. But then the solution is always, oh, we just need more socialism. And so this time we can end up going all in on socialism. And what we're seeing now, right, the protests and the riots and the looting is just a small taste of what's going to happen. And we're already seeing politicians and businesses caving into the demands, right? All of a sudden now we have to, you know, do all this to combat, you know, this systemic racist threat that doesn't actually exist, right? And now all of a sudden we need reparations or whatever it is.
$14 trillion is what Robert Johnson is saying. Mayor Garcetti in Los Angeles said he's cutting the funding of the police department by $100 or $150 million. So less police. It is like an Orwellian backwards world that we're living in. So if this hyperinflationary scenario unfolds in the next 5, 10 years, 15 years, I mean, are we going to see an emergency, levy on people's 401ks? So anybody who, you know, the retiree folks who have a few hundred thousand dollars in their IRA are going to get 10% of it siphoned off? Or where's the money going to come from?
Well, again, they don't have to do that. They just print it, right? So as they print money, they steal the purchasing power of the money you have. So they don't have to take your money. They just take your purchasing power. That's the danger of the monetary system that we have now, right? They don't physically have to take the money away from you. They can just create as much money as they want and spend it, right?
But then how do wages catch up? Because let's say in a one-year period, if the dollar hyperinflates to 50% in 1 year, then all of a sudden the people who are making $20 an hour are making the equivalent of 10. Now they can't pay their rent. So then their boss is going to have to, the owner of that company is going to have to up the, how does that work? Because it's sort of like a tit for tat, right? I mean, how do the wages catch up with?
Well, they never catch up. That's the problem. They always go further and further behind. So yes, wages will rise in hyperinflation, but just not nearly as much as the price of other goods, right? Wages are just the price of labor, right? But those prices will not go up nearly as much. And of course, when the economy is devastated by hyperinflation, a lot of the employment opportunities are going to vanish. So if you don't have a job, it doesn't matter that wages are going up if you're not earning any of those wages at all. So you have a lot more people that are unemployed that have zero wages, right? All they get is whatever stipend the government creates for them. But you can never get out of it. And you're impoverished. There has never been a society that has gone through hyperinflation where it hasn't impoverished the nation. It's not like there's any way that you could just, my prices went up tenfold, so just pay me 10 times as much and we're all okay. It doesn't happen. And you wipe out, the savings. If you wipe out the savings of a society, you destroy the ability of that society to invest and grow. So it really is a crippling. I mean, it's like losing a war. I mean, it really is devastating to an economy.
Are you envisioning a scenario where like farmers markets sort of pop back up and there are people selling food that they've grown on their farms for literally physical silver and gold coins because the dollar will be so worthless that nobody wants to use it, or the price fluctuates so much, or it's dropping so dramatically over a 30-day period that within a month the price of goods changes so much that people don't want to accept it?
Oh, that is certainly a possibility. I mean, there's no question, and you should be prepared for that. You should hope that doesn't happen, but you better have some silver coins in your house, because if we do get the hyperinflation, right, what I think is going to happen initially as prices really start to rise, the politicians are going to try to scapegoat greedy businessmen or capitalists or speculators, the way, Nixon did in the 1970s,
The when communists they imposed, said the landlords were to blame for everything, the evil landlords and the adults, educators.
So what's going to happen is the government is going to impose price controls, the government is going to make it illegal. They'll say it's price gouging, right? You can't raise prices, right? Your prices are fixed or whatever that is. And so the minute that happens, you're going to have widespread shortages of goods because the prices are going to be artificially low. So those goods won't be available legally. The way they'll be available is illegally on the black market, right? Because if you really want to buy stuff, right, you know, you can do it, but you can't do it legally because then the merchant is going to get arrested or punished. So you have to go illegally. And of course, if their transactions are going to be illegal, what are they going to be denominated in? They're not going to be in money that the government can track. I mean, you're not going to be able to sell your goods for dollars or take a credit card when you're breaking the law selling it. So I think people are going to be selling in silver or gold. They're going to be bartering or, you know, they could, in theory, take cash, but I don't think they're going to want cash because if the dollar is losing value so rapidly and you have goods that have real value, let's say you are a farmer and you're selling some food. Why are you going to give away your food for pieces of paper that by the following day could be worth nothing and you had real valuable food? So when paper money really starts losing money rapidly, businesses can't afford to accept it in exchange for their valuable goods. So they have to exchange it for something that's also valuable that's not going to lose its purchasing power. So the farmers are going to want to sell their produce, right, and get paid in silver. So then they can use that silver to buy the things that they need. I mean, what good is it if they sell you some food and then you give them some paper and by the time they try to spend it, nobody will take it because it's lost so much value. So you get an underground economy in real money, you know, and you know, that is a worst case scenario, but that might happen. But, I mean, you know,
how do we avoid it at this point? Because like you said, everyone keeps kicking the can down the road. Nobody wants to do what actually is necessary. No politician's going to get reelected if they simply say what needs to be done or do it. I guess President Trump sort of probably maybe the last hope, sort of holding the dam back from bursting. Maybe if he gets
reelected. Really. I mean, Trump, a lot of people, look, Trump is a politician like anybody else. I mean, he is making political decisions. Nothing Trump does is really for the good of the country. It's all politics. He wants to get reelected and he's playing ball. I mean, he's not draining the swamp. He's, you know, part of the swamp. I mean, the swamp is a lot deeper now that Trump is there. I mean, I think Trump has a different style than a lot of career politicians, but the substance is all the same. All the decisions are politically motivated. They're not economically motivated, but to answer your question.
You don't think that he puts America first, though, all of his anti-globalist legislation
No, that's just talk. That's just campaigning. He's not putting America first. He's putting his reelection first. That's what he's putting first. It's, you know, now, I agree that, you know, he wants things to look better while he's president because he thinks it reflects better. He doesn't want to have to go through a big cleansing of the economy on his watch and get blamed for it. And of course, you know, he was claiming that we had the greatest economy in the history of the world when that wasn't even close to the case. I mean, maybe we had the biggest bubble in the history of the world, but we didn't have anywhere near the strongest economy.
Well, but unemployment was at an all-time low for 50 years.
No, it wasn't. It was at a low based on the way we measure it now. I mean, it's been a lot lower in decades in the past when we had a more honest way of measuring unemployment. In fact, when Trump was a candidate for president, he called out the phony unemployment numbers that the Obama administration was touting. When Obama was saying the unemployment rate is 5%, Trump said the real rate is 30% or 40%. So all of a sudden he's president and now unemployment's 4%, and that's the real rate? What happened to the 20% or the 30%, you know, from, you know, before he was elected? I mean, so these numbers mean nothing. The reality is the American economy is a shadow of what it used to be. It's a hollowed out. I mean, a lot of the criticisms that Trump had were valid, except the minute he was elected, he became a champion of everything he criticized. You know, the trade deficits got bigger under Trump. They didn't go down. Right, he was, one of his big things was we gotta shrink the trade deficit. It got larger, not smaller. The budget deficits got bigger. He said, "Oh, we have too much debt." Well, now we have much more. You know, he was critical of the Federal Reserve because their monetary policy was too easy. As soon as he became president, he began criticizing them because he said they were too tight. Right, he wanted the Fed to be political the way they were for Obama.
So do you think, as an outsider, he comes in, he says what he thinks needs to be done or what really should be done, but then now that he's the captain of the ship, he sort of realizes that the ship is malfunctioning, it's leaking, he can't do what he wanted to do because it's just impossible And so yeah, he's trying to just prevent the ship from sinking the best that he can.
Well, it's going to sink no matter what. He's just hoping that he gets off before it does, right? That's what all politicians do. But so the problem is when Trump campaigned, he never actually talked about what needed to be done. He was accurate in his assessment about the problems. And because he was speaking candidly about how bad the problems were, that resonated with a lot of voters who had been spoon-fed lies about how great things were, right? The media, the Obama administration, Wall Street was talking about this great recovery, right? But the average guy wasn't experiencing that recovery because it didn't exist on Main Street. Maybe it existed on Wall Street thanks to the Fed, but a lot of the resources that were propping up Wall Street were siphoned off of Main Street by that monetary policy. So when Trump laid it out cold about how bad the U.S. economy was and how, you know, we had disintegrated over the years and that America was no longer the great nation that it used to be, that was a true statement. And Trump just said, look, elect me and I will make America great again. I'm not a career politician. I'm going to do what it takes to make this country great. I'm going to do what the career politicians refuse to do. And so that was a great message. I voted for Trump, right? A lot of people voted for Trump because they liked that message. But Trump never actually said what needed to be done, right? And what needed to be done was massive cuts in government spending. But Trump did not campaign on that. He didn't say, I'm going to elect me, I'm going to cut Social Security, I'm going to cut Medicare, right? He didn't talk about making government smaller. He talked about cutting taxes, which is the fun part. But in order to cut taxes, you have to cut government spending because taxes fund government spending. And if you cut taxes but keep spending, well, how do you pay for the government? Because the real cost of government is what it spends. So what you really need to do is think of government spending as taxation, because every dollar the government spends, we need to pay for it. And if the government doesn't collect the taxes, then it has to create inflation. And so we're going to pay for the difference with a loss of purchasing power of our money, which is what's happening. So when Trump gets into office and he finds out that the only way to really make America great again is to make government small again, that the reason America was so great in the past was because we had a tiny government that really didn't consume much in the way of resources. So we had a strong economy because we didn't have all these taxes. We didn't have all these regulations. But then he gets to Washington and he realizes that there's all these special interest groups that want all that government spending, that want all those programs, that want all that regulation. And he's not willing to challenge the status quo. And he doesn't want to disappoint voters by telling them, you can't have this government money. The country can't afford it. So he couldn't actually do anything to make America great again. So all he could do is get the bubble bigger and pretend that that was making America great again. So that's all he did, right? We just continued the policies of Obama under Trump, which was a continuation of the policies of Bush. So all we did is we got the stock market to go up, right? And we created some more fake prosperity. And now Trump became a champion of that fake prosperity. The same fake prosperity that he rightly criticized as a candidate, now he embraced it and said, oh, look, you see how successful I am? Look, we have a new high in the Dow. But as a candidate, he said, who cares about the Dow? It's a bubble. Ignore the stock market. It's not real.
I don't know if I would call unemployment at an all-time low. I know you dispute those numbers, but I mean, just anecdotally, I know tons of people who have been very prosperous over the last few years. We're seeing some manufacturing returning to the country. We're seeing trade deals.
We're not
Foxconn's
seeing that.
Foxconn's coming. The auto industry is...
No, it's not. The auto industry is a disaster. Yes, we had a bubble in auto loans thanks to the Fed. But GM and Ford, which are the only two American automobile companies left, are going to go bankrupt again. They were bailed out once before, and they're probably going to get bailed out again because they're probably headed for bankruptcy again. But no, manufacturing hasn't returned. That's a myth. We continue to lose manufacturing jobs under Trump. I mean,
but aren't new service jobs? I mean, everybody's using Instacart now and all of these sort of new... You know, energy is neither created nor destroyed, right? The scientific axiom. But isn't that true of jobs and all these people like Andrew Yang who are saying that 30% of the jobs are going to disappear? I mean, that's not really true because nobody could have anticipated that companies like Facebook and Twitter would be...
I am not somebody who believes that prosperity and automation is what's destroying jobs. No, it's government regulations and taxation and spending. Look, even before COVID-19, even before we lost all the jobs that were created since 2008, but even before this recession started, job creation under Trump was slower than it was under Obama, right? And all that happened is the trend that was in motion for falling unemployment under Obama continued under Trump. He didn't bend the curve, and we continued to create the same low-quality, part-time, service sector jobs under Trump that we were creating under Obama. That didn't change. The only thing that really changed is that the stock market made a new high. And why did that happen? Because the Fed went back to printing money. They went back to rate cuts and quantitative easing. And they did that in 2019. They did that a year before COVID-19 came around. So the Fed already had to rescue the Trump economy because it was imploding, because it was phony. It was in a bigger bubble than the one that he inherited from Obama. But I guess he realized that he had no choice politically. If all he cared about was getting reelected, then he couldn't do what was necessary to make America great again. So instead, he did what was expedient to keep the bubble inflating so maybe he can get a second term. But I don't think it's going to work. I mean, I think if Trump really cared about the country, he would have tried to do something in his first year when the Republicans had the House and the Senate. What he should have done is what I suggested. He should have refused to sign an increase in the debt ceiling. And had he done that, he would have forced the government to dramatically cut government spending and brought about a balanced budget in his first year. The president had the ability to do that. There is no way that they would have been able to override his veto. There would have been enough Republicans who would have taken advantage of that to really shrink government spending. But instead, that didn't happen. I mean, we increased government spending dramatically and cut taxes at the same time. So we poured gasoline on fire. That's all we did.
A couple more things I want to get into, and I appreciate your time. And Peter Schiff's the host of his own YouTube channel, and you can check it out over at the Peter Schiff channel. And since we're talking about inflation and monetary issues, I know a lot of people are wondering, and myself included, about Bitcoin. I know your stance on Bitcoin, but I want to kind of have you share it with the audience. I do not know that much about Bitcoin. Obviously, a lot of people are pointing to that as an alternative currency. And you are you're not exactly a big fan of Bitcoin. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, well, because I don't believe that story. I don't believe that Bitcoin is digital gold. Right? I think it's fool's gold, and I think the price is eventually going to collapse. But certainly the people who are in Bitcoin and own Bitcoin have a strong motivation to try to convince other people that it is digital gold and that they should buy it, because that's the only way the price is going to go up is if more people buy it, because you can't actually use Bitcoin to do anything, right? It's not used as a medium of exchange. It doesn't circulate as a payment. People just hoard it, right?
But there are retailers that accept Bitcoin. BitPay and all of these sort of intermediaries.
No, they don't accept it. Like my company, Shift Gold, right? We, in theory, accept Bitcoin, right? We work with BitPay. But what BitPay is it's an intermediary. So what happens is, let's say somebody wants to buy some gold from Shift Gold, and they want to buy $10,000 worth of gold, right? If they have, at today's market value, $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, right, they can go to my website, Shift Gold, and go to the link to BitPay. And BitPay will buy their Bitcoins from them and pay and give them dollars. And then they use those dollars to buy gold. So it's just an intermediary step where you're selling one asset to get dollars, and then you're using the dollars to buy gold. Well, you could sell stocks. Somebody can call their broker and sell their shares of IBM and then get cash and then use that cash to buy Shift Gold. That doesn't mean they're using their IBM stock to buy gold. No, they're selling their IBM stock, and they're using the cash proceeds to buy gold. And that's what's happening. All the companies that use BitPay is just helping people sell their Bitcoin so they can get cash and then use that cash to buy whatever they're going to buy.
But isn't it just one step away from actually then, instead of using an intermediary, from it being the actual medium of exchange? Because, I mean, it does have many of the properties of money. It's fungible, it's divisible, it's portable. I mean,
well, it doesn't have, it doesn't have the most important quality, which is intrinsic value in and of itself. I mean, money is supposed to be a commodity, right? That's where money came from.
But a dollar doesn't, a piece of paper doesn't have intrinsic value anymore.
Yeah, but okay, but you're jumping a step ahead of yourself. So first, if you're talking about money versus currency, right? So money, right, is a marketable commodity. It's by definition the most marketable commodity. So what happened was when people use barter, right, people would exchange one good for another good or one service for another service for a good. But that was cumbersome. Like if I was a chair manufacturer and you were a tailor and I wanted to get one of your suits, well, what if you didn't want one of my chairs? I mean, how are we going to exchange? I mean, I got chairs or, you know, you got suits. But people discover that, hey, what if everybody exchanges for gold? Because gold is a valuable commodity. People use gold in all sorts of things. But gold has all these properties that make it good money that clothing doesn't have, or wheat or oil. I mean, gold as a commodity has all these characteristics that lend it to being money, better than other commodities. And so gold became money. Now, what Bitcoin did is it copied all of those qualities that gold had that made it the best commodity to serve as money. But it doesn't have any of the commodity qualifications that you need to even be considered for money. Because there's no actual value to the Bitcoin itself. It's just about, I'm going to buy it because somebody else will buy it and someone else will buy it. And it's just a pyramid scheme.
Now, that may be true for some of the Bitcoin people who want to get rich off of it, but some of the diehard libertarian folks want to get the central banks out of the monetary system. They want the government not to have a hand in it whatsoever. In theory, and again, I don't know much about it. I don't own any Bitcoin. It seems like an interesting idea. I see them going to $10,000. I'm like, I don't know if I would want to invest in that or could invest in that. I know friends of mine who think that one Bitcoin can't even be divided. They think it's like a dollar. So I don't know, you know, if a lot of people don't know maybe that much about it. I certainly, again, don't. There is a core, you have to admit,
divisible.
Of people.
I mean, you can divide it, but look, this is a pipe dream that some libertarians have, that this is the solution to getting rid of central banks. Look, if you don't want central banks, we already have gold. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. We have real money that we could use. We have gold. We have silver.
But
we don't
have
to
send
try
that
to
across,
it.
You know, the country or around the world like you
yes,
can.
You, well,
as you can, perhaps a Bitcoin. And again, I'm not like a Bitcoin fan, and I'm skeptical
of it because
I don't know who owns the
reason that you. Yeah, the reason that you can send it is because it has no substance. It has no real value. So ultimately, the fact that I can send it someplace is going to be meaningless when nobody wants it, I mean, because there's nothing that you could do with it. I mean, if it wasn't for governments, governments are pretty powerful, but you can have gold stored someplace and I can digitally transfer my ownership to you instantly, you know, for free. So it's not hard to move gold ownership around the world. It's much easier now than it used to be. Back when we had fiat currency or paper currency that was backed by gold. Now we can have a digital currency backed by gold, and it would work even better. So that's possible. But when you have digital currency backed by nothing, now you're back to fiat, which is the point that you made about, hey, but you know, dollars don't have any intrinsic value, so why do they work? Well, they don't really work. That's the problem, right?
Well, they work because people believe in it, but then the fear is that once people stop believing in it, the house of cards collapses. So as long as there's a faith in that, or as long as the society or community agrees that that is the medium of exchange, then it's sort of, it does function, at least for a period of time.
Yes, it does function for a period of time, and then it doesn't, right? And the main reason that the dollar is successful is because once upon a time, the dollar was defined as gold. It was gold. Then we had paper that was backed by gold. And so initially, the currency in the United States, even though the currency itself was paper, it was backed by gold. And so over time, we gradually took that backing away, and people continued to use the paper as if it were backed by gold. But you have this long tradition of use. You have all these contracts in dollars. You have rents. You have bonds, insurance policies. You have a whole economy that is predicated on dollars. And you have a U.S. government that imposes taxes on every American citizen, and the only thing they accept in payment is U.S. dollars. So there is a real demand for dollars, even though they have no intrinsic value. If you don't want to go to jail every year, you need to accumulate dollars so you can send the U.S. government their cut of what you've earned. So you do have this built-in demand for the currency. But over time, the dollar keeps losing value, right? It's not a good store of value like gold is. And all fiat currencies eventually collapse. I just think that Bitcoin's life cycle is going to be a lot shorter, right? Because it didn't have that long tradition that, you know, the Federal Reserve note had. And there was never built around Bitcoin, you know, all of these payments. I mean, people don't get paid their salary in Bitcoin. Landlords don't, you know, collect rent in Bitcoin. I mean, you know, Bitcoin is not, you know, there aren't all these companies borrowing and issuing notes in Bitcoin. I mean, we're not using it, right? It's just,
but Jamie Dimon was you know, downing Bitcoin now. Isn't JP Morgan getting involved in it, or they're doing something?
The only way that any of these big Wall Street firms have gotten involved is simply to allow trading in Bitcoin to take place so that they can make a commission or benefit from it. I mean, they're not investing in it themselves. They're not, you know, recommending it to their clients. But look, hey, if there's people dumb enough to trade Bitcoin and Wall Street thinks they can make some money on the action, well, they'll try to get in on it.
Concerns, and let me know if you have any answers to this, Peter, or anybody in the comments watching this, is the people who make the software for the Bitcoin wallets that connects to the blockchain and gets the private key and the public key. I mean, you know, if you have a problem with your PayPal or your Venmo or your checking account or something, like, there's, you know, at least a customer service, there's the FDIC that insures it. Who do you go to if the app, your wallet, has a glitch in the software and it just won't open anymore, right? And,
yeah, you know, I thought that happened. I had a wallet that I got, this guy, Eric Voorhees, I don't know if you've heard of him. He's, you know, in the Bitcoin world. And so I did a debate with him at the Soho Club in New York. It was a Reason, I think, or, you know, sponsored it. It was Bitcoin versus gold. Of course, I was a gold guy. He was a Bitcoin guy. And so after the debate, we went out to dinner and he set up a Bitcoin wallet for me. And he transferred me $100 worth of Bitcoin at the time. And I sent him back $50. So he kind of like, he let me keep 50, you know, with my wallet. So he set it up for me. And, you know, he never told me the password or the seed phrase, whatever you're supposed to have. All I remembered is I had a PIN. And I thought that PIN was my password, right? Because every time I opened up my wallet to check my Bitcoin, I would type in this PIN. Anyway, what happened was, not too long ago, somebody kind of called me out on Twitter, on, you know, hey, Peter, you really have a bunch of Bitcoin. You know, I heard you own Bitcoin and you're just trashing it. I said, no, I don't. I own like $100 worth, because I actually had gotten some, somebody gave me some Ether and somebody gave me some Bitcoin Cash, because I had the wallet. So I had like $100 total of these three cryptocurrencies. And so I said, look, this is all I got. And I said, if you want to see, here's my wallet. I put my wallet address out there. And somebody said, well, what's your address? I'll give you this guy, Anthony Pompliano. I call this guy Pomp. He was going to give me $100 worth of Bitcoin if I just put my address out there. So I said, okay, here's my address. Now, of course, he never actually gave me the $100, but a bunch of other people gave me Bitcoin. And so I ended up with about a quarter of a Bitcoin, a third of a Bitcoin, which at the time was worth a couple of grand, maybe $2,500, right? All of a sudden I had. People gave me the Bitcoin for free. So then one day I wanted to look at it, and I couldn't get into my wallet anymore. And my PIN didn't work. And so what I found out was the wallet had updated with some new software, and so my PIN didn't work. So now I couldn't use the PIN. Now I needed my password. Well, I didn't know my password. I only know the PIN. I contacted Eric. He didn't remember. I didn't know the seed phrase. So my Bitcoins are gone. I can never retrieve them. Right. So, I mean, so that's part of the thing. If you don't have all this, if you make a mistake, then you can easily lose them. Obviously, if I forgot my PIN for my bank account, I go back to my bank. I show them my ID. They give me a new PIN. Right. That's impossible to happen with your money in a bank, but, you know, you can easily lose it.
Some will argue that that's good, because then nobody can, you know, the government can't even get it. You can't be taxed for it, et cetera. I stopped paying attention to it when I started seeing the forking. I sort of wrapped my mind around it a couple years ago, and then it forks, and then the forks fork again. And then just when I think I understand it, now you get this debate over the miners and who's going to carry which kind of crypto. And then there's the Bitcoin Cash, and now there's the Bitcoin VC, and I'm just like, okay, I'm.
But the other problem with Bitcoin, apart from its lack of intrinsic value, is it actually is very expensive. If I actually wanted to transfer you a dollar's worth of Bitcoin or $2 worth of Bitcoin, I mean, the cost is prohibitively high. I mean, it's okay if I wanted to send you $10,000 worth, but if I wanted to buy something small, it's too expensive and it takes much too long. I mean, it takes hours and hours for the transfer to take place. So it's not an efficient medium of exchange, even if it was stable, which it's not. That's the other problem, is you can't price goods and services in Bitcoin because the price can fluctuate too dramatically in too short a period of time.
I think the transfer costs are a debate, which is where the forking comes in with Roger Ver's camp and the Bitcoin Cash, and he's trying to make it an actual medium of exchange. And then the Bitcoin Core, whatever the heck it's called now, are the people where they see it as digital gold as a store of value instead of a medium of exchange, which, you know, so you have those two different camps, It looks like one of them is winning out, and it became a big mess. So I stopped paying attention.
The problem is you can't store what you don't have, right? Gold is a store of value because of the value of gold, right? Gold could be used in jewelry. It can be used in industry. It's used in electronics. It's used in medicine. It's the most useful metal on the periodic table, right? So it is a very valuable commodity in and of itself, right? And the beauty of gold is that it doesn't decay. It doesn't tarnish. And so a year from now, 100 years from now, the gold that I have today will be just exactly the same. Even if I take gold and I make it into a piece of jewelry, they can melt that jewelry down in 100 years, and it's exactly the way it was before it was melted down to make the jewelry. None of its characteristics are diminished at all by the fact that it spent some time, you know, as a necklace or whatever it is. So gold has all this value that you can store for future use. But Bitcoin has no value. I can't do anything with my Bitcoin today, and so I can't do anything with it tomorrow. Now, I can give it to somebody else if they want it, but what if they don't want it anymore? Because the only reason somebody wants it is because they think they can give it to somebody else. And the reason you have a whole bunch of people that want it is they think they're going to get rich. Look, there are a lot of people who think Bitcoin, which is now, it's 9 to 10,000 is the price of Bitcoin, right? And there are a lot of people that think it's going to be 50,000, 100,000, $1 million of Bitcoin. So they're hodling, right? They're holding on to these Bitcoins because they think they're going to get rich. And the reason they think they're going to get rich is because people who bought Bitcoin at 10 cents or a dollar or $5, they got rich, right? People that got in early and put in a bunch of money or even a small amount of money, based on where it is now, the guys that got in really early, they got rich, right? Now you have other people that are getting in thinking they're going to get rich too. They're not. They're going to go broke, right? Because the people that got in early need to cash out to actually convert their paper profits into actual profits. And so the early adopters need to convince the newbies that they're going to get rich too if they pay $10,000 for these Bitcoins that they bought for $100 or $200, whatever they paid. But it's not going to happen. The people that are buying now are just the bag holders, right? When the music stops, the bottom is going to drop out, and this whole thing is going to implode. It's all just one big bubble. That's all it is.
Peter, if people want to listen to more of your creative financial metaphors, which I find extremely entertaining, tell everybody where they can find the Peter Schiff Show.
Yeah, so I do my own podcast, The Peter Schiff Show. You can listen to it, iTunes, or any place that has podcasts online. I do them now live to video on my YouTube channel, so you can subscribe to The Peter Schiff Schiff Report on my YouTube channel. I've got about 340,000-ish subscribers now, so you can join that and get a note on YouTube every time I post one of these. So either way, I'm doing usually two or three a week, sometimes more. A lot of it depends on what's going on in the market. If there's some really breaking news that I really feel like I got to chime in on, I'll do a podcast. So you can listen to those. But more important too than just listening is doing something, acting. Because as I said, I think a lot of people are going to get wiped out, and I want to help spare as many people from that fate as possible. Plus, I also want to be somewhat instrumental in the political argument that is going to follow this collapse. Because again, you're going to have the camp that is going to blame it on capitalism and say we need more government. And then you're going to have my camp that's going to say, no, this is what government did to us, right? This is because of the Federal Reserve and big government. And what we need is honest money and we need less government. And so I want the people in that camp to have resources, not to be broke, right? So the more people that not only listen to what I have to say, but act on it and preserve their wealth, I think people who have real wealth in 5 or 10 years are going to be in a much better position to help move the country in the direction that it needs to go than if they're broke themselves, right? It's like if I get enough people on a lifeboat, then we can help the people who are, you know, drowning get out of the water. But if you're drowning too, because how are you going to help anybody? You're just trying to stay afloat yourself. So people have got to, you know, follow the advice that I'm giving as far as getting out of the dollar, avoiding this tax, getting gold and silver, having portfolios of quality foreign assets outside of the United States so that you can repatriate your wealth, right? When everything collapses, if you've got all your money safely out of the U.S. and into gold, you can use your resources in a productive way to help rebuild the country. What are you going to do if you're just as broke as everybody else? So listen to what I have to say, get educated, and encourage other people, encourage your friends, your coworkers. Hey, listen to what Peter Schiff has to say, because most of what you're hearing in the mainstream media is a bunch of nonsense, a bunch of propaganda, right? The only thing spreading faster than COVID-19 these days is ignorance, particularly economic and financial ignorance, and it's being spread by the mainstream media. So get more people to listen to what I have to say, read some of the books that I've written. You know, you go to, you find them on Amazon, but also become a client, you know, protect your wealth. And if you have, you know, friends or family members, encourage them to contact Euro Pacific Capital and move some money here, especially retirement money. People who have IRAs or 401k or pensions, right? This is money that you're planning to live on in the future. Well, your money is going to retire long before you do, unless you do something now to protect it. And that's what I'm trying my best to do for as many people as I can.
Well, we know how fake the political and cultural issues are on the mainstream media, and I'm sure that the financial news is just as fake. So thanks for sharing your insight with us, Peter. And unlike the Peter Schiff was right video back in 2008, I certainly hope you're wrong, but the indicators aren't looking very good. So thanks again for your time, sir.
Sure thing. You can hope I'm wrong, but don't bet that I'm wrong.
That's a good point. Thanks again.